Cool. So just as an introduction, this talk is a bit of a follow-up to this somewhat unsuccessful panel at the Fifth Hope. Shardy was there. We had about five of us, a number of people from 2600 Net IRC, and just other random girls who happened to be at Hope. And we basically had this hour-long bitch session about bad experiences that the different members of the panel had as members of the information security community, as members of the hacker community, or in computer science. And it was really cathartic for all of those of us who were involved, but it wasn't very productive. And so what I want to try and do today is offer some concrete strategies that we can use going forward as a community to encourage the participation of women in the open source and hacker communities, rather than just like whine about how stuff sucks, because that tends to not be so productive. So the first thing I want to address is why you should care. Why you should care about the fact that sitting in this audience, there are almost no women. Sitting in the audiences at all of these talks, there have been very few women. This is a problem on two fronts, in my opinion. The first reason that you should care is about the community. And the second reason that you should care relates to people outside the community. As a community, we're missing out on the participation of perhaps the next Linus, or you know, even Kevin Mitnick, who may be not participating because she feels maligned and not able to participate as a member of the community. The flip side to that is that there are people out there who want to participate, who feel that they can't, and who are therefore missing out. As a community, we're missing out, and other people are missing out on our community. My personal experience in being involved in the hacker and open source communities have been very positive, and I feel like an obligation to get other people involved in this and encourage people to participate. So I think that we need to consider the possibility that we're not being true to the ideal of judging people based on their contributions, of being a true meritocracy, if for whatever reason there are no women almost that come to these conferences that participate in the community. What are we doing wrong, and what can we do better? So to get briefly into the question of why there are so few women in this community, I've also been involved in the physics community and the computer science community academically, and I think that there's a lot of overlap of women's experience in these other communities that apply to the hacker and open source communities as in terms of why they haven't participated. The biggest one historically has been a lack of role models. There aren't sort of like the figures in the popular media in terms of who participates in our community are generally not women, and that has a major impact on people's involvement and people choosing to get involved in this community. There is a certain amount of, and I don't want to stress this point too much because, again, this gets into being negative, but there's a certain amount of bad behavior that goes on that discourages people who do get involved from continuing to be involved. And I think that that's something I'll address in terms of things to do better. But behavior at conferences, behavior in the workplace, that has a really negative impact sometimes on women's decision to participate or to continue to participate. And one of the really unfortunate things is that women who do choose to participate are more easily discouraged from participating than men, and that exists as a problem both in computer science and physics, and is something that has to be fought actively in the academy, and I think we have to fight it as well from a practical perspective. They've found specifically that in computer science teaching, bad teaching has a disproportionately negative impact on women versus male students, and so when trying to get people involved in this community, that's something to consider in terms of when you're teaching and introducing people how to be doing it and to take an active interest in learning teaching methods. And that contributes to a lot of turnover in in the community. I know just from the Toronto 2600 community, the amount of turnover of women participants, even just in the 2 years since I've been involved, is dramatically higher than the turnover of male participants, even just, you know, looking at people who show up at meets and attend other related events in the hacker community and open source community. So I wanted to directly go into what we can do about it and looking at success stories within the computer science teaching establishment and also in physics, and see how we can apply these directly to the hacker information security and open source communities. And there's a couple of things that have worked actually really well within... Can you maybe turn that down a little? Thanks. There's a couple of things that have worked really well within the open, within the computer science teaching community. There's a study that was done at Carnegie Mellon University between, I think, 1998 and 2003, and it was published in a book called Unlocking the Clubhouse, Gender and Computing. And in those 5 years, they were able to bring enrollment of women from 7% to 42%, and also increase the rate of completion of the program from 20% at the start to 80%, which was the same rate of completion as male students. And they did that by doing a couple of very specific things that encouraged women to start the program in the first place, but also to stick with the program through the 4 years that it takes to get an undergraduate degree. And the Carnegie Mellon model has been applied successfully at other computer science teaching faculties around the world since then. The really specific things that they did in terms of getting people involved were getting people to consider going to computer science as a major, and which applies sort of generally to getting women involved in technology, is very specific forms of encouragement and mentoring. It was found through this Carnegie Mellon study that women tend to not be into technology for technology's sake, but rather look to direct practical applications of technology. So when you consider that you want to like get your friend or your girlfriend or whoever using Linux, rather than being like, look at Linux, it's really cool and open source and you should use it because it's cool, which, you know, is true, but at the same time, it might be more effective to say, look at you, Linux is really cool, you could use it to get that old junker computer in your basement working so that your kid can have a computer of their own, or so that rather than having to upgrade your computer, you'll be able to continue using the same one for a while. You know, sort of specific practical applications of computer science, information security, teaching people about stuff like phishing so that they can protect themselves, rather than just like, yeah, I'm a hacker, this is really cool, you should get involved. Like, making that connection from this is an interesting field to these are the specific ways that it can be applied in the real world is the most effective way to get women involved in information security and computer science and the open source community. The metaphor that they used in the Unlocking the Clubhouse study was the idea that women don't dream in code, and I thought that that was particularly descriptive of the difference between the idea of doing technology for technology's sake versus actually wanting to have a practical application of it. Having role models for women getting involved and being able to point to specific people in the community who have been doing this for years and do an awesome job of it and saying, you know, it's not true that there are no female hackers. There's lots of female computer scientists. Grace Hopper and Anita Borg are the two big American examples. The women at Bletchley Park who helped crack Enigma and win the Second World War. Like, there are historically lots of awesome examples of female figures in computer science. And also in the hacker community, you have people like Raven Adler, Val Henson, who's a kernel hacker, and a couple of the women in the Ghetto Hackers, that, you know, there are these women out there who are role models, who exist, who have forged the path for other women to follow. And I think the biggest thing that we can do as a community is to hold true to the ideal of the hacker ethic, that hackers should be judged by their hacking and not by their degrees or their job titles, that it's your contribution that makes the difference, and that it shouldn't be assumed that when you're at a conference that you're there as somebody's girlfriend, or that sort of attitudinal problems that everybody thinks that we don't do it, but maybe you need to call people on it when they do it. So, and that's really helpful. So I didn't have too much other than that to say, and I wanted to open the floor to people's comments and questions about other things that they think might be really positive in terms of getting women involved in this field. And other than that, yeah.
Question for you.
What's your question?
So in this study, you said the most descriptive term is that women don't dream and code.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's because of a biological difference of how women are wired different than men, or do you think it's societal and just because of how things have been up to this point?
But
do you think that women could dream and code if they were put on equal footing in terms of society in this field?
It's a really good question, and it's one that's come up in the physics community. I don't remember the name of the dean of, I think it was Harvard, recently. Yeah, Lawrence Summers. There's a big controversy in the physics community over this whole idea that maybe women are just less naturally suited to doing hard science and physics in particular. And I think that there's a lot of that attitude within the computer science community as well. In the Unlocking the Clubhouse study, which was the one at Carnegie Mellon, they found that a lot of women in the computer science faculty experienced the attitude of you're only here because you're a girl, like that they had got in because of affirmative action, when it was absolutely not true, and Carnegie Mellon did not do any affirmative action type admissions at the time, and I don't think they do. They still don't. While they have changed their admission policies, and that was part of what made them increase their admission to 43%, they don't actually have any traditional affirmative action type admissions. As to the question of whether it's like whether if it's a biological thing, I think that there's very little evidence that this difference in interest has anything to do with biology. One of the things that sort of like very first year women's studies, equity studies, is the idea that studies that show sameness in the social sciences don't get published. So you very rarely see a study that says, like you very rarely see published a study that says, yeah, women and men are just as good at math. You don't ever see that. You only ever see, because the publications like Nature and stuff, they do not have an interest in publishing those studies. It's a pretty well-known fact in the social science research community that those studies don't get published. So there's a slanting towards this idea that there's a biological difference between men and women in terms of mathematical abilities, spatial reasoning, and all those things that lead into being a good computer scientist, when I personally don't feel that that's the case. And there's research into there's a lot of research into the distribution of intelligence among men and women that show that while intelligence is distributed differently, that the average man and the average woman have the same intelligence. There's just a different distribution along the curve. And again, that brings in questions about how we're defining intelligence and stuff that are kind of out of the scope of this argument. But I think that one of the things that I learned from this Carnegie Mellon study is that even if women who become involved in computer science or the hacker community do not dream in code, that's not the requirement for entry. The requirement for entry is to want to learn cool stuff and do cool stuff. It's not eating, sleeping, and dreaming it. So, does that sort of answer your question?
I was curious where you stood on that.
Yeah, no, I definitely think that there's no biological thing about men versus women that means that there are like four women in this room, so yeah.
Hi, my name is Bethany Niger. I work for Carnegie Mellon School of Computer Science, a full-time staff member.
Awesome.
And I'd like to say, yes, I've had dreams that I was coding.
I totally have too. I've had lots of dreams that involved a lot of Tetris, but and code as well, but point that was made in the Margolis study was that this was not a common experience for women, while it was described as a very common experience for male computer science students. So that's cool.
In terms
seem to be indicating that, at least based on the study, that men look at technology and men in and of itself, whereas women look at technology as sort of a news to women?
Yeah, that was what was found.
Okay, if that difference isn't biological, and I think I agree that it isn't, do you have any idea of how that would be socialized?
I think it has to do a lot with the nurturing socialization that women go through, as opposed to the sort of the technical socialization that men go through. I hate to always rely on the Carnegie Mellon study, but it is a really awesome study, and I would heavily suggest that anybody interested in this idea read up on it. It's actually a really good read, the book that was published out of the study. But one of the things that they talked about was the idea of the computer in the boys' room. And even in my personal experience growing up, I did not have a computer in my room. I only got my own computer when I left for university. Whereas, and even within my family, as my little brother has grown up, he's got his own computer now. And I don't mean that, like, my parents are sexist or anything, but this is a fairly common experience for people, for young men and young women. I think that that's going to be less true going forward as, I don't know, I think people in the States use AIM, like kids in the States use AIM, whereas up in, yeah, in Canada, like, basically everybody under 15 is on MSN, like, as soon as they get home from school, and a lot of kids have their own computers from a fairly low socioeconomic strata up, and it is being used increasingly as a social tool by kids of both genders, and I think that that's actually going to have a really positive impact going forward. In terms of the involvement of men of women in computer science as a field, so does that answer your question? I think
there was a 2001 conference at Carnegie Mellon called "Girls, Women in Technology," and the point was asserted that there aren't enough cool games for young girls. And that might have something to do with the problem.
I think that that's very true. And I mean, if you think of what the games that have been produced traditionally for girls have been, there was a lot of like pet simulators, and there were like Barbie games, and yeah, like, and they all kind of sucked. Whereas like, even me growing up, one of the things that got me a lot into computers was like the old LucasArts adventure games. These are games that are not like first-person shooters. I don't really like first-person shooters. Once in a while, I like to go out and like shoot lots of people on a computer, but most of the time, I want to play something with a really good storyline. And I think that the decline in the adventure game industry, you know, somebody should do a study and see if the decline in the adventure game industry has any correlation to the decline in women in computer science, because there actually has been a decline, and that's one of the, overall, in the 90s and 2000s, there has been a decline in women. Since I think 1988 was the peak of women's enrollment in computer science in the States, and it's been downhill since then, other than at Carnegie Mellon. So.
Yeah.
sorry.
Making the the assumption that it's not and there's no biological basis. Using me as an example. When I was 6 years old, my father brought home a computer, put it in the living room. And, I said, oh, hey, teach me how to program. So, I practically taught myself how to program on it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my sister, that was the year she was born. So, she grew up having, the computer in the living room, but she never showed any interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm a programmer. My brother's job is, he programs for a living. And, my sister's never shown any interest in it except, email.
Yeah.
So, do you think that, there are differences in how, my brother and I were parented versus my sister, or just some luck, or,
I think that it's a little bit of luck, it's a little bit of parent, it's a lot of parenting, and it's a lot of more general socialization. There's been a lot of research into the way that gender roles like career gender roles in the media impacts kids and imprinting on kids as to what kind of roles they're going to choose for themselves to go into to study in school and to go into as a career. And there's no one thing. Even if it was partly biological, there's all these different factors that come into play in terms of career choices and choices of interest. So.
Yeah.
actually, sort of as a follow-up to that, the one of the things that I found the most interesting out of this Carnegie Mellon study was the idea that interest is deeply tied to confidence in a subject, and the chapter on it was actually called The Nexus of Confidence and Interest, and the idea that as you become more confident in a particular discipline, a particular area of study, you become more interested in it, which I think is pretty obvious to anybody, that you're good at something, so you're going to become more interested in it. But the flip side of that is things that break your confidence in a subject make you lose interest in it, which seems kind of counterintuitive. Why would my not feeling good about coding make me think that I'm not interested in it? But if I'm feeling like I'm really struggling, I can't get Linux installed on my laptop, nothing's working, well, maybe it's just not the right thing for me to be doing. Maybe I should, go back to Windows and give up on the whole open source thing. There's this really deeply tied association between confidence and interest, and because of things like poor teaching negatively affecting women more than men, and therefore destroying their confidence, they have a much higher tendency to then become disinterested, which is really just not confident.
So I also work for a Linux users group, and I see, particularly at InstallFest, what happens is a woman will come in with her laptop or her desktop, and all of a sudden there's a swarm of guys who want to jump in there and take you
away. I'll help you. Yeah, and take the keyboard away, and I think that's the big key for teaching. Well, it's the key for teaching anybody about computer stuff is to not be in the driver's seat. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the agile programming philosophy, but one of the things heavily involved in that is the idea of pair programming. And in pair programming, generally speaking, the person who is less experienced is supposed to be driving, i.e. at the keyboard. And I think that that applies equally well for stuff like InstallFest, stuff, any sort of computer science teaching. It's really, really hard to learn looking over somebody's shoulder. And I don't know if any of you have ever had the experience of trying to learn by looking over somebody's shoulder, but it's like, it's intensely frustrating. So that's a really good point.
What about like the junior high school level? What kind of changes can be made there to encourage women to get more technical skills?
Well, they found that a number of studies have been done into primary teaching methodologies and the impact on career choices and educational choices for women. They found that even teachers who think that they're really good about gender in the classroom, when they actually study the numbers of times that they call on male students versus calling on female students, there'll be like this really dramatic disproportion, like this really dramatic skew towards male students, in particular in science and math and computer science classrooms. And so having a real consciousness of how often you're calling on students of different genders, even if there's, the really enthusiastic couple of guys that sit in the front row and ask lots of questions, and sometimes you need to consciously call on the people who are less, maybe kind of meek in the background and saying, I might know this answer, but I'm not going to be really confident about it, and encouraging confidence through mentoring and through active questioning. So those are a couple of things that have been shown to be really effective.
Given all these recently returning with women in games, and how there are all these games that they said, oh, we're trying to encourage women, we think that women will really like this. Here's a game for women. Look, your character can run around with a team. And I was wondering if you see that sort of
The Lara Croft problem, right? Sure, she's this like awesome, empowering female character. She just happens to have like boobs that are like balloons, and so maybe women aren't going to be so comfortable playing with that. And it is really a catch-22 in terms of, maybe not a catch-22. It is a problem in trying to advance these role models, but then them not really being very positive role models, and I don't really know what the solution to that is. Other than, keep trying, kind of thing. I guess that's all we can really hope for. Yeah.
Have you found common allies with yourself and other women in the teaching field?
Well, honestly, I think the biggest thing for me is I wish that I'd read this Carnegie Mellon study before I dropped out of physics, because the whole idea of confidence being directly tied to interest was my exact experience with second year quantum mechanics and having a teacher who didn't speak English. And I had this, like, so I had this teacher who was very well intentioned, but I just could not understand what he was saying. And not having the confidence to go out and ask people for a lot of help on stuff that I wasn't getting. And there were just all of these different factors, which were like the classical factors of women dropping out of technical fields. And they all happened to me in second year. And if I had known about that going in, I think that would have been really empowering and probably would have allowed me to ride through it. And I think that finding that there are these same factors that discourage women from participating in these varied fields, physics, computer science, and mathematics, I think that knowing some of those things going in would be really powerful for women participating in these fields. I think that that's really true. It's a network effect in the same way as the whole, like, adding one developer to the development team just makes it more complicated. Adding one woman to the computer science faculty, to the physics faculty. At the University of Toronto, which was my home institution, there were 3 female physics profs out of, like, a faculty of about 40, which was actually pretty high in Canada, so it was kind of sad, and there wasn't that mentoring and support network, and having that in place, every single woman who joins this community, who starts actively participating, encourages other women to participate, so.
Well, do you know how this compares to other cultures where, you know, women are, you have different social roles and so forth, like, you know, say, you know, sometimes women are allowed to, you know, combat in the military and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know the statistics a bit better in this case in the physics community, but there's a number of countries in the world, like in Canada at least, the number of physics postgrads, like physics postdocs, so people who have gone through all the way to a PhD program, is something like 4%. And basically, in undergrad, there'll be 40%. In master's, there'll be like 30%. There's this idea of the leaky pipeline. At each level of academic achievement, there are fewer and fewer women involved in physics. The difference with Canada versus a country, for whatever reason, politics aside, Iran has something like 60% of their physicists are women. And I don't know what the reason behind that is, but what that really suggests is this isn't a biological thing, this is a cultural thing, because if a country like Iran can have 60% of their physicists be women, there's something else going on culturally. And I think that, I'm sure that the statistics are, I don't know what they are off the top of my head, but I'm sure that if somebody were to look into the statistics for computer science participation across cultures, there would be dramatic differences between countries. Yeah. Cool. Did I see your hand over there? No.
What can peer groups like Launch and stuff do outside the high schools to encourage women participation?
I think with LUGS, I mean, at least from my personal experience, a lot of what needs to happen at LUGS is a matter of self-policing. I talked a little bit about bad behavior being discouraging for women in terms of, like, harassment and the whole idea of, you know, getting sort of swarmed when you show up. There are a couple of people at the Toronto LUG who actually have made me so uncomfortable that I've stopped going. One of the guys there actively talks, like, he heckles other presenters when they're talking, and people make jokes while he's heckling about his, like, BDSM fetish. And, you know, it's funny, and, like, I kind of brush it off, but that makes a lot of people actively uncomfortable. And so, I think that that's the big key for LUGS is policing that, like, self-policing that kind of bad behavior, you know, maybe tapping that guy on the shoulder and saying, I think your jokes are making people a little bit uncomfortable. Can you maybe not do that? So, that, like, it sucks to have to come out and say, like, tell people to not be assholes, but that's a lot of what has to happen at LUGS. So.
There's a specific FAQ on the web for for how to attract women to your learning program. So mm-hmm. I suggest you check it out.
Yeah.
It's exactly what you're saying, that you need self-belief. It's not just the girls who need to speak up. It's the guys who need to speak up and say, you know what, this is exactly why we're not getting women to come in here, because you want to sit up there and spout cuss words and be a rude person to not just women, but to everybody, and it's just annoying.
Yeah. And there's, like, at my lug in Toronto, there's a couple of people who will consistently heckle speakers in a very aggressive way. And, you know, they're just joking around, but it makes it that much harder to go up there and be a speaker. And, I think we do it, too, in the information security community at the hacker cons. And it's really awesome that somebody like Shardy has the confidence to come up to go up on stage and have his friends in the front row drinking and, like, heckling him. And that's totally awesome, but that does make it really hard for somebody else to come up and talk if they don't have that community network of support. And it's really hard because I want to find a balance between saying, no, you shouldn't do that, and here's how to do that in a way that doesn't discourage people from participating. Because that is, like, the drunken rowdiness is part of this culture. It is part of this community. It's part of the fun. And how do you find a balance between continuing that because it's fun and making it not hostile? So.
Well, doesn't the drunken rowdiness essentially make it sort of like an old boys club, which, you know, sort of just self-perpetuates, and, you know, the drunk rowdy boys can join the club and, you know, the girls just
or have to be drunk and rowdy too to get into the club, and some people can handle that and some people can't, and that's a question that I thought a lot about going into this talk and was not really sort of able to come up with any conclusions other than call people on really egregious behavior and self-police.
I think that has a lot less to do with male or female, but just your own self-confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Being somebody who's been up there, both as the person getting heckled and the heckler, I think it has a lot more to do with self-confidence than gender, which directly relates back to what you said before about interest versus confidence. So it might not directly be a problem, but indirectly.
It's a problem it's only a problem because we already have this existing problem of a lack of confident women hackers. Like, that's how it becomes a problem. It's not a problem in and of itself, I don't think.
It seems like there's, like, three stages going on here, and each one, I'm not sure how any of us in this room could solve the problem. You've got the early childhood where you've got parents and teachers telling girls they can't do this technical stuff.
And it's not even necessarily being directly told that you can't do it. It's just not encouraged.
Right.
And
then you have the lack of role models, which, of course, you're not going to have the role models unless you have people ahead of you. And then finally you have the people misbehaving, and, wow, a girl, what are we going to do? And the best way to solve that is to get more women into the culture.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So you kind of have to address the first two in order to deal with it. So it's like if there were just like 50% women at this conference or at like a lug or anything, the like, oh my God, let's like glom on the girls would just not happen because there would be lots of girls. And so rather than it being this crazy ratio, that just wouldn't be the case. Yeah.
How much of the problem do you think is caused by the women? For example, at that Pope panel, the posters inside the men's room.
Yes. Why cable flames.
Live girls come to this room at this time to see live hacker girls of GZZ.
Yeah. She was really trying to be funny, and it just really wasn't funny.
For example, the Kisses girl.
Yeah, she's been at several. She was at another conference too. Yeah.
And somebody wrote an article on her where she made up a fake story about she was running some sort of social experiment, and then there's another newspaper story about how she was looking for money to get a bus home. She was just basically making up stories and taking in money from these poor, desperate guys
yeah.
who pay a dollar to piss her.
Yeah.
How much
it was really sad.
It was. And that, it made me angry when I saw it.
Yeah.
Because one of the smartest people in the field that I know is female, and she was just rich.
Yeah.
How much of the problem do you think is caused by women's actions as opposed to the glom on, hey, look, it's a cute girl, let's take people to
it? Yeah. I think that that's another question of self-policing that has to be addressed, and that I know I personally haven't been very good about addressing that, even confronting Cable Flame about the posters in the bathroom, that as women already involved in this community, we have to be holding each other up to, not to good behavior, but to encouraging each other and to encouraging other women to become involved. And it becomes hard to self-police when it is such a minority situation that, as it is right now, like, I think that that's why it has been traditionally hard to self-police in that respect, but I think it is something that people, specifically women already involved in the community, have to be conscious of.
Do you think there's a taboo against telling the girl who's saying, oh, look at me, I'm poor and defenseless and I don't know anything, do my stuff for me just to get attention? Is there a taboo against
calling people on that? Oh, okay.
Because of the thought that any attention is good attention, even if we don't agree with the tactics, it's still getting a foot in the door.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that's one of the reasons for the taboo against
anything? I think that that's definitely one of the reasons, the whole idea of not wanting to discourage even that kind of lame, I'm showing up to sell kisses participation. Seeing it as still participation, even if it's not positive participation, and being able to call people on the fact that it's not positive. So.
I'd actually like to respond to what you just asked about listening to the girl who's making up all the stories, and say, what about the guy who does stuff like that? The guy who does all the heckling in Toronto. There's a lot more of them, but it's something you're going to experience apart from nature, and in a situation where there's such a minority, people who might want attention or might want to abuse that attention are going to find it a very easy place to find it.
So the problem is, though, if you have statistically less women, if you have one woman for every 10 guys, the woman that stands out doing that sort of bullshit story is going to be a lot more noticeable just because she stands out because of the numbers. So it's potentially more damage. It's not worse, but it's just,
I agree.
Self-policing is really important for men and women. Like, yeah.
I was just suggesting it's important not to cite that as a possible cause for the shortfall of participation of women as a whole, because there's one or two.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that it's from what I've seen, it's something that most women I've talked to know exists, but don't want to approach because it's a lose-lose situation. Whereas other women I know, that makes them 10 times more angry than the guy that's being misogynist at the woman that is encouraging them to be like that. So I was just wondering.
Yeah. Well, it's especially hurtful when somebody is doing something like that because of.
Probably worse when it comes from
the thing. Yeah, exactly. When I think that the girl doing the kissing booth at Hope and at DEF CON was more hurtful to the women who actually, like, managed to come out and participate. All like 20 of us at Hope, and I don't know how many women show up at DEF CON, but I've been to hacker conferences that had under 1% participation, and that's just really sad. Like, and open source conferences, AstraCon, the Asterisk conference in October, there were 5 women of 600 attendees. That's not even 1%. Like, there's something wrong there.
I mean, but I think that sort of the relativism phenomenon will decrease and it will improve as you have more women, you know, at the conference and at the event.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you have a whole bunch of women or a whole bunch of any group, it's much harder to single out one and say, oh, look, they are now representative of this very small group.
Yeah.
So if you have 10 women and one of them is acting like an idiot, and you have 500 men and 10 of them are behaving badly, it's much easier to hold the one up as a good example. So I think the ultimate solution then becomes encouraging more women to move into the field.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
obviously not going to solve this problem overnight. Temporarily, as a workaround, do you think it's a good idea from the mentors to say, look, these are the types of idiots you're going to encounter,
yeah,
and don't let it break your spirit?
And I actively do that in encouraging women to participate in LUGs in different... There are so many user groups in Toronto, it's kind of ridiculous, but, like, I personally go to, like, 5 different ones and will often talk specifically to the other women who show up and sort of, like, oh, you're planning on going to T-LUG. You should totally go, but don't give this guy your phone number. Like, really, really don't. He's really, really annoying. Because if she didn't know that she shouldn't give creepy stalker guy her phone number, she would get creepy stalker guy would probably stalk her, and then she would not go back to T-LUG. And so sort of like that kind of active, not really, yeah, I guess it's kind of warning people as to the pitfalls of their participation. It sucks that we have to do that, but it is a good first step. So, but I think that sort of like, and the conversation here has really reinforced for me that a lot of what we have to be doing is self-policing, in terms of calling people on being assholes when you can see that it has a specific negative impact on people. And the LUGs are a really good example of that. So, yeah.
Are there any other women's organizations or computer science? I've heard of Linux Chicks.
There's Linux Chicks. There's the Anita Borg Institute for Women in Technology. I know Google does an Anita Borg scholarship. There's Sisters, which is an email list, spelled SYSTERS.org, I believe. There's the Grace Hopper, I can't remember what it's exactly called, but it's like the Grace Hopper Congress of Women in Computing, and that's in San Jose this year, I think. The Linux Chicks and the various email lists on there are awesome resources. And Women in Science and Engineering, I don't know, does that exist in the States? That's pretty big in Canada, so, yeah. And the various, institutional bodies, I know the Association for Computing Machinery has a committee on the status of women. I don't know if it's called the Committee on the Status of Women, but they have a women's special interest group, as do most of the international physics associations. And the country-specific physics associations and the International Union of Applied and Theoretical Physics. I don't remember if that's the acronym, but yeah. So there are a number of groups out there. Mm-hmm. And if you do a Google search for unlocking the clubhouse, you'll find the homepage for that Carnegie Mellon study. And there's also a book that came out of it that... I've even got here. And that's what it looks like. Another group that I thought of is, they're called the Gender Changers. They do summer camps and like weekend outings that are like basically hacking workshops, where they do hardware hacking, Linux install fest, that kind of thing. They're mostly based in Europe, though, and Canada. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if there's any other questions or comments. Yes, there are.
Okay. Well, okay. I have a question for a hacker friend who has the tech kids. They're mostly daughters.
Yeah.
So would you have any advice that I could relay to them on how to raise hacker daughters?
Give them a really old computer and, like, lots of Linux ISOs, generally, like, encouragement is the really big thing. Talking about role models is a really important thing, whether it's like hacker role models or just generally computer and science role models, like computer science and physics and all that kind of stuff. Role models about that. I think those are the big ones. Acting as a mentor for your kids, or even finding like an external mentor who, if they do show an interest, because maybe they are really into music or something not computer related, but giving them all of the options is really the key. So.
I love taking things apart when I was a little kid. I mean, I'm sure all of you did. So, as a dad, I can see it being second nature to go, oh, here you go, son, take this apart, you'll have fun, it's what, it's not yourself up. And not doing that with your daughter. And just the fact that it doesn't occur to you that she might want to take it apart too.
I, to the point that, like, I always got in trouble for taking apart stuff when I was a kid. And, like, what's going to be more discouraging in getting involved in computer science and science in general than getting actively discouraged when you show an interest in technical things? Like, that's, I think that's really the key, is to just be encouraging. I think that where a lot of success has happened as like in the larger scale has been in the education system. One of the things that they did at Carnegie Mellon that was like really intensely cool was when advanced placement computer science switched from Pascal to C++, they had like a summer camp for high school teachers to learn C++ and gender issues in computing. So they had all these high school teachers from across the states come to CMU to learn about, you know, sort of they got them in with the C++ and then they taught them about gender and computing. And subsequent to that, they had a dramatic increase in enrollment in computer science at Carnegie Mellon, again from 7 to 42%.
Could that just be because the women prefer C++ to Pascal?
Possibly, although I don't know why anybody would prefer C++. But it's a good question, but I think that where there has been a lot of success institutionally has been in higher education. As for what other sort of large social ways of changing this, I'm kind of lost on that one. I honestly don't know, and I lean towards the idea that there aren't, that this has to be a grassroots thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of the times, like, people don't like to write about
Well, yeah, and how well published was this Carnegie Mellon study in the popular media? What resources are made available, and like to parents to teach their daughters about technical stuff, like. I tried to give you some constructive suggestions, but I couldn't say, oh, well, you should read this book, and there's a bunch of articles about how to get your daughters into computer science. So, we done?
Pretty much?
Okay. Cool. Yeah, so thank you, everybody, for participating.